Welcome! You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And here's another thing that needs to happen in these groups, is believe victims. You know, do you know what the rate of false accusation of rape is?
No.
It's about 3%, which is the same as the rate of false accusation of burglary. So we should presume, any time a woman says that she was sexually assaulted, we should presume immediately off the top, knowing nothing about her, him, anything, we should presume that there's a 97% chance she's telling the truth.
That's the voice of Derek Jensen. On this week's show, we finish the second part of our interview with Derek Jensen on violence against women and the politics of consent. Stay tuned.
I wanted to speak about this idea of the declining baseline. You know, when you begin so low in terms of what you can expect as a human being, as a woman, in terms of your own identity within a society, a subjective identity to me means our own agency, ability to change and transform the political, economic, and social interactions that, you know, that create the living conditions and the sustaining conditions for our lives. So when we talk about those who are oppressed and who begin with this diminished identity and disparaged relationship to begin with, how do we break out of it? How do we create or subjectivize ourselves? How do we become persons, you know, in our own rights, with visibility, if everything around us creates an environment of objectification?
Well, I just want to comment on how much I love your questions. You're always such a you're just such a great interviewer.
Thank you.
When you were asking that question, I was thinking about what Judith Herman says in Trauma and Recovery about the first thing that's important for survivors of domestic violence, for them to gain some safety. I think when someone is in an inherently unsafe situation, that it's really hard for them to recover, to get away, and to change. And part of the reason is because abusers, and once again I'm talking about the propaganda of the system, I'm talking about this on an individual level, the propaganda is absolutely incessant. It's beating you down all the time. And it's destroying your autonomy at every moment. And it's really hard. I mean, the good news is that they're telling lies, and the lies have to be constantly reinforced. But the bad news is that they do it incessantly. And something that comes up right now for me, I'm just thinking about this, that it's not really a game, it's a model. There's a model that I call the abuse model, or the abuse game. And that's, I sometimes do this with friends to, only in context of this model, to help all of us understand how abusers work. And the way the model works is that there's two people, and one of them says to the other, says a compliment to the other. And then the second person has to play the abuser and take whatever the other person says and turn it into an excuse to make the abuser seem a victim, and then pick a fight. And I'll just do a couple examples real quick. So say something nice about me.
You're a beautiful thinker. I love the way you write.
Oh, I'm a beautiful thinker. So you actually don't think I'm a beautiful person. I'm just a thinker. Is that right? Is that what you're telling me? Why are you insulting me so much?
You're misunderstanding. I love everything about you.
Oh, so I'm misunderstanding. It's not that you're not being clear. My point, I'm not really picking a fight here. I'm just showing. I mean, have you ever experienced this in real life? Where you say something and the person just blindsides you by taking it entirely out of context and then finding some way to get mad at you. One time I was doing this with a friend. I said, okay, really stump me. Give me something I won't be able to come back with. And the friend said, well, you're perfect. And I was stumped for a while, and I thought and thought and thought. And I called the friend back later and said, I got it, which is, okay, why are you always putting me on a pedestal? That's so much pressure. And my point is, this is just a sort of a humorous way to show a dynamic that happens constantly. My point on bringing this up at all is that this dynamic happens so often that it's so hard. It's like you're always walking around wondering when you're going to get hit upside the head, either physically or intellectually or emotionally or something. You know, you said this very, very nice thing to me, which I really appreciate, by the way, and I didn't mean any of the stuff I was saying there. But if I would have responded the way I did, really, if I would really responded that way, you know, if you and I were in some sort of relationship where you couldn't realistically get away, and I was doing that to you constantly, it would make you completely crazy, or it would make me completely crazy if it was going the other direction. And so one of the things to do is to try to get away from that. And if you can't get away, there's also the importance of at least finding relationships that are then uncontaminated by the perpetrator, and finding people with whom you can communicate who don't buy into the perpetrator's ideology. And one of the ways I put this in my 20s, I started realizing that I couldn't talk about the things that were the most important to me because I didn't think my friends would understand. They weren't abusive, but they were all nice people, but they were all pretty mainstream. And so what I found is that I was afraid that if I talked about the things that were important to me, that I would lose my friends. We all talked about sports or whatever, you know, and then I finally couldn't stand it anymore. I did start talking about the things that were important to me, and I did lose my friends. And the thing is, I found new friends. And what I say about this now is I don't have any friends in my life with whom I have to revisit Civilization is Bad 101 every time I open my mouth, because I don't want to fight the culture and my friends too. So a supportive community is really, really important, to find people that you don't have to have an argument with over whether pornography is really harmful to women, you know, or, you know, revisit those basics so often. And
what happens then when, you know, our communities, our support networks become a place of danger? Because, you know, as you point out, there's also the issue of power, right? Power is not distributed equitably in our society. And even when you find spaces that you consider a place outside of the constant abusive sense of normative behavior that society demands of women, whether as objects of desire, as, you know, the fault lines of rape and all the kinds of violences that become the succumb women. Sometimes, you know, as an activist within environmentalist groups, you know, you could be raped and someone says, well, let's just talk about it and let's all come together and find a way to restore the peace. And that peace invariably means silencing the victim, silencing what happened, because this small little fragile space we've created has now been contaminated and we need to cleanse it. How do we deal with that?
Well, that's a terrible, terrible problem. And I think the way you deal with that is, where you deal with that particular problem is actually really simple, which is you have a zero tolerance policy for abuse of women. And a zero tolerance policy for male pattern violence. And if one of your comrades sexually assaults a woman, then that comrade is removed from your community. No questions asked. One of the things that oppressors do is they get you to transfer your allegiance to them. So you identify with the oppressor. You identify with those in power. And that's true. We talk about our president. He's not my president. He's the corporation's president, you know? It's not my government. It's their government. There was this line by Georges Monbiot in an article right after Fukushima where he talks about why they need to expand nuclear energy. And he's saying, how else will we get the energy to run our factories? And it's like, let's change this sentence to, how else will the capitalists get the energy that they need to run their factories? And that's an entirely different question once you break your identity with the oppressor. And it's the same within our community groups, that we need to make our allegiance at every moment to the victims of the culture. So make your allegiance, and I'm telling you to make your allegiance, obviously. We all need to make our allegiance to women. And we need to make our allegiance to people of color. And we need to make our allegiance to the dragonflies, and we need to make our allegiance to the victims of the culture. That doesn't mean you have to approve of everything every woman does, you know? I mean, I was not a big fan of Margaret Thatcher either, you know? Does that mean she should be raped? No. Does that mean she should have had power? No. So just because somebody is a member of some oppressed class does not mean that you have to ignore everything they do. But at the same time, we have to be very clear that we will not accept in our community men doing violence to women. And because what happens in those meetings is they always end up being this complete gaslighting where the woman has to then defend her experience of having been raped. And I've had women describe this process to me as undergoing of having their experience then raped as well. And I don't understand at all why you would want to keep a comrade in your community who would have sexually assaulted a woman anyway. It's like, good riddance. You know, I don't know if I've mentioned on here before. I think I have. My friend Charlotte Watson, who used to run the Battered Women's Program for the state of New York. And she's wonderful. One of the things she does is she asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? And she asks people in taxi cabs, on subways, everywhere. She asks every man she sees. It's wonderful. And her answer is that women can't do it alone. That what needs to happen is men start to need to start saying, you know, I just heard you call your girlfriend a bitch. I am not going to play basketball with you anymore until I hear you apologize to her. I know this guy, this college student in Michigan, is pretty cool. He was rooming with some people, and he moved out because the roommates refused to stop using the word bitch in front of him. And he said, look, I don't like that word. It's disrespectful to women. I can't be in a house where people use that word, where men use that word. And they wouldn't stop, so he left. And here's another thing that needs to happen in these groups, is believe victims. You know, do you know what the rate of false accusation of rape is?
No.
It's about 3%, which is the same as the rate of false accusation of burglary. So we should presume, any time a woman says that she was sexually assaulted, we should presume immediately off the top, knowing nothing about her, him, anything, we should presume that there's a 97% chance she's telling the truth. You know, 2 days ago, I was in town, and I had my mom's car, and it got broken into. They broke a window and then stole some stuff. I went to the sheriff's office because I need to file a police report in order to file insurance. And, I mean, the cop didn't come out and say, he came out and looked at my mom's car, and we talked, and he, you know, gave me the number I needed to give to the insurance company. And he never once said, huh, so did you break this window yourself, sonny boy? You know, I mean, that would have been absurd. So, sorry to rant like this. It's just something that makes me really angry that if some woman says she was sexually assaulted, believe her. That's the first thing you should do in your community.
What do we do as women, you know, when the very institutions of violation that that turns us into objects are supported by women, are maintained by women, and this allegiances to culture, to religion, to, you know, the, you know, community ethos that, you know, we're one group and we have to be solid, and so we ignore the abuse of women, of other women, you know, by simply the way we interact and the kinds of prescriptions we demand of others.
There's a part of me that says I should just not answer that at all because I'm a white male and I'm not a member of an oppressed group. But then there's a part of me that recognizes I'm a white male, and so I give opinions on every damn subject. That was supposed to be a joke.
I love you. I was laughing.
Okay, thank you. So what I guess I do want to say is I mean, I don't have a prescription for that, and I shouldn't have a prescription for that because I'm a guy. But what I can say is that in my reading, it seems to me that that's a problem that many members of oppressed classes end up feeling, I mean, end up experiencing, that, you know, Malcolm X talked about that in the African-American community. And for crying out loud, we have Uncle Tom's Cabin, you know? And we have Harriet Tubman saying the line about, I could have freed hundreds more. And so I think the same thing is true for women. The same is true for every oppressed group. And frankly, it's also true for within abusive families that, you know, it's a classic thing that survivors of domestic violence as children more often end up hating the bystander than the perpetrator.
The reason I asked you the question, I know it's an unfair question, but the reason I ask it is I am in community radio. We often talk about what community means, but we never really problematize that question, right? Who's invited? Who's left out? What kinds of things, you know, policies do we ignore when people of color are proposing it? Because the people in the positions of decision making are primarily white. And, you know, I mean, the kind of relationships that tend to, even though we speak about non-hierarchical organizing, are maintained through that participation. You know, when we think about including more voices of women, we predominantly have meant white women. You know, we don't see a lot of coloring within radio stations, for instance. So to speak about allegiances, I think it's also important to recognize who are our allies, you know, and those allies can sometimes be men, and those allies can be males like you who refuse to prescribe, who are committed to eradicating violence and also to create a real respectful coexistence of the genders, to create parity effectively in our society is what I'm seeking, I suppose.
I think everything you said is great.
I feel that in many ways our struggle for liberating ourselves from a masochist society, from a culture of violence, requires both men and women to recognize when we are being masochists.
I think that we need to recognize when we are being masochists. I think we also need to recognize when other people are being sadists. You know, I just reread this great book called The Sociopath Next Door by Martha Stout. I read it years ago, and I just reread it the last week or two. And she gives like 12 steps or 13 steps or something for dealing with sociopaths near the end of the book. And one of her steps, which I think is the most important, is cut them out of your life. I mean, because you can't win. You know, if somebody's going to play the abuse game with you or the abuse model, you will never win that game with them. You will never be able to say, because the point was for them to pick a fight and had nothing to do with what you were actually saying, you can't actually constructively engage. And another way that I've said this for years, and this was a hard-earned lesson for me, is that you can never win an argument with an abuser. You can't, because they cheat. And because they're not trying to actually have a discussion or an argument, but instead they're attempting to win at all costs. More than winning, the real point is to beat you down. And the point is that we're not actually the problem. You know, the problem was the abuser in the first place. So I think in addition to finding ways that we ourselves are participating to do, like Harriet Tubman, you know, to find ways we're slaves and then squeeze out every drop of slave blood to switch over to Chekhov. In addition to doing that, I think we need to find ways to identify abusers and to just take them out of our lives. Remove yourself from the situation. I've taken a one-strike-you're-out policy on abusers in my life, and it's been very, very helpful. Yeah, we all snap at each other, and we all say things that are hurtful accidentally, or you know, we get upset and say something we shouldn't say. But that's different. We know abuse when we feel it, and if somebody is mean to me or somebody is abusive to me, I cut them out with no regrets at this point. And that's been one of the smartest personal decisions I've ever made. I think we should do the same thing communally.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. I'm infinitely grateful to you for being with us.
Well, I'm very grateful for your work in the world and for your, as always, wonderful questions. I look forward to doing this again.
Thank you again, Derek. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. That was Derek Jensen. We've come to the end of our show. Please visit his website, derekjensen.org, and discover a wonderful collection of books that will most certainly change the way you think about the world and about your own agency as a citizen.
Thanks for tuning in. We're going to finish the show with the song Drop of Water by Dana Lyons. Bye for now.
There's a drop of water on the wall, and the drop's about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, the wildness in my soul. And for once in life, for once in life, I know I'm not alone. For the mountains make our bones, with the oceans in our blood, our feet planted, planted firmly in the mud. We are alive, the burning embers in our eyes, the tingling touch upon our skin. And in the heat of passion, we begin to understand that we are of this land, that we are part of Earth. And when it's threatened, we will fight for all we're worth. We watch the dam come crashing down, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free. Drops about to fall, and it falls into a trickle, and the trickle's flowing down, down, down to the ground, and the moss begins to grow. Watch, 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 watch the water flow, and watch the current become a stream, busting through the seams, cracking through the concrete, bending down the steel, in a raging that is real, a tearing torrent you can feel. Feel the thunder growing, thunder underground, and in my heart, the chains falling apart, water rushing to the sea. And now the river, now the river, now the river, now is free.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.